Chapter 4 Continued. Dear Ron, and Harry, if you're there, I hope everything went all right and that Harry is okay, and that you didn't do anything illegal to get him out, Ron, because that would get Harry into trouble too. I've been really worried, and if Harry is all right, will you please let me know at once? But perhaps it would be better if you used a different owl, because I think another delivery might finish your one off. I'm very busy with schoolwork, of course. How can she be? Said Ron in horror. We're on holiday. And we're going to London next Wednesday to buy my new books. Why don't we meet in Diagon Alley? Let me know what's happening as soon as you can. Love from Hermione. Well, that fits in nicely. We can go and get all your things then, too, said Mrs. Weasley, starting to clear the table. What are you all up to today? Harry, Ron, Fred and George were planning to go up the hill to a small paddock the Weasleys owned. It was surrounded by trees that blocked it from view of the village below, meaning that they could practice Quidditch there, as long as they didn't fly too high. They couldn't use real Quidditch balls, which would have been hard to explain if they had escaped and flown away over the village. Instead, they threw apples for each other to catch. They took it in turns to ride Harry's Nimbus 2000, which was easily the best broom. Ron's old shooting star was often outstripped by passing butterflies. 5 minutes later, they were marching up the hill, broomsticks over their shoulders. They had asked Percy if he wanted to join them, but he had said he was busy. Harry had only seen Percy at mealtime so far. He stayed shut in his room the rest of the time. "Wish I knew what he was up to," said Fred, frowning. "He's not himself. His exam results came the day before you did. 12 OWLs, and he hardly gloated at all." "Ordinary wizarding levels," George explained, seeing Harry's puzzled look. "Bill got 12, too. If we're not careful, we'll have another head boy in the family. I don't think I could stand the shame." Bill was the oldest Weasley brother. He and the next brother, Charlie, had already left Hogwarts. Harry had never met either of them, but knew that Charlie was in Romania studying dragons and Bill in Egypt, working for the Wizards Bank, Gringotts. "Dunno how Mum and Dad are going to afford all our school stuff this year," said George, after a while. 5 sets of Lockhart books. And Ginny needs robes and a wand and everything." Harry said nothing. He felt a bit awkward. Stored in an underground vault at Gringotts in London was a small fortune that his parents had left him. Of course, it was only in the wizarding world that he had money. You couldn't use galleons, sickles and knuts in muggle shops. He had never mentioned his Gringotts bank account to the Dursleys. He didn't think their horror of anything connected with magic would stretch to a large pile of gold. Mrs. Weasley woke them all early the following Wednesday. After a quick 6 bacon sandwiches each, they pulled on their coats, and Mrs. Weasley took a flower pot off the kitchen mantelpiece and peered inside. "We're running low, Arthur," she sighed. "We'll have to buy some more today. Ah, well, guests first. After you, Harry dear." And she offered him the flower pot. Harry stared at them all, watching him. "What am I supposed to do?" he stammered. "He's never travelled by flu powder," said Ron suddenly. "Sorry, Harry, I forgot." "Never?" said Mr. Weasley. "But how did you get to Diagon Alley to buy your school things last year?"
"I went on the Underground."
"Really?" said Mr. Weasley eagerly. "Were there escapators? How exactly—" "Not now, Arthur," said Mrs. Weasley. "Flu powder's a lot quicker, dear, but, goodness me, if you've never used it before—"
"He'll be all right, Mum," said Fred. "Harry, watch us first."
He took a pinch of glittering powder out of the flower pot, stepped up to the fire, and threw the powder into the flames. With a roar, the fire turned emerald green and rose higher than Fred, who stepped right into it, shouted, "Diagon Alley!" and vanished. "You must speak clearly, dear," Mrs. Weasley told Harry as George dipped his hand into the flower-pot. "And mind you get out at the right grate."
"The right what?"
said Harry nervously, as the fire roared and whipped George out of sight too.
Well, there are an awful lot of wizard fires to choose from, you know, but as long as you've spoken clearly. He'll be fine, Molly, don't fuss, said Mr. Weasley, helping himself to flue powder too. But, dear, if he got lost, how would we ever explain to his aunt and uncle?
They wouldn't mind, Harry reassured her. Dudley would think it was a brilliant joke if I got lost up a chimney. Don't worry about that.
Well, all right. You go after Arthur, said Mrs. Weasley. Now, when you get into the fire, say where you're going.
And keep your elbows tucked in, Ron advised.
And your eyes shut, said Mrs. Weasley. The soot...
Don't fidget, said Ron, or you might well fall out of the wrong fireplace.
But don't panic and get out too early. Wait until you see Fred and George.
Trying hard to bear all this in mind, Harry took a pinch of flue powder and walked to the edge of the fire. He took a deep breath, scattered the powder into the flames, and stepped forward. The fire felt like a warm breeze. He opened his mouth and immediately swallowed a lot of hot ash.
Diagon Alley, he coughed.
It felt as though he was being sucked down a giant plug hole. He seemed to be spinning very fast. The roaring in his ears was deafening. He tried to keep his eyes open, but the whirl of green flames made him feel sick. Something hard knocked his elbow, and he tucked it in tightly, still spinning and spinning. Now it felt as though cold hands were slapping his face. Squinting through his glasses, he saw a blurred stream of fireplaces and snatched glimpses of the rooms beyond. His bacon sandwiches were churning inside him. He closed his eyes again, wishing it would stop, and then he fell, face forward, onto cold stone, and felt his glasses shatter. Dizzy and bruised, covered in soot, he got gingerly to his feet, holding his broken glasses up to his eyes. He was quite alone, but where he was, he had no idea. All he could tell was that he was standing in the stone fireplace of what looked like a large, dimly lit wizard's shop. But nothing in here was ever likely to be on a Hogwarts school list. A glass case nearby held a withered hand on a cushion, a blood-stained pack of cards, and a staring glass eye. Evil-looking masks leered down from the walls. An assortment of human bones lay upon the counter, and rusty, spiked instruments hung from the ceiling. Even worse, the dark, narrow street Harry could see through the dusty shop window was definitely not Diagon Alley. The sooner he got out of here, the better. Nose still stinging where it had hit the hearth, Harry made his way swiftly and silently towards the door. But before he'd got halfway towards it, two people appeared on the other side of the glass, and one of them was the very last person Harry wanted to meet when he was lost, covered in soot and wearing broken glasses. Draco Malfoy. Harry looked quickly around and spotted a large black cabinet to his left. He shot inside it and pulled the doors to, leaving a small crack to peer through. Seconds later, a bell clanged and Malfoy stepped into the shop. The man who followed could only be his father. He had the same pale, pointed face and identical cold grey eyes. Mr. Malfoy crossed the shop, looking lazily at the items on display, and rang a bell on the counter before turning to his son and saying, "Touch nothing, Draco." Malfoy, who had reached for the glass eye, said, "I thought you were going to buy me a present." "I said I would buy you a racing broom," said his father, drumming his fingers on the counter.
"What's the good of that if I'm not on the house team?" said Malfoy, looking sulky and bad-tempered. "Harry Potter got a Nimbus 2000 last year, special permission from Dumbledore, so he could play for Gryffindor. He's not even that good, it's just because he's famous. Famous for having a stupid scar on his forehead." Malfoy bent down to examine a shelf full of skulls. "Everyone thinks he's so smart. wonderful Potter with his scar and his broomstick.
"You have told me this at least a dozen times already," said Mr. Malfoy, with a quelling look at his son, "and I would remind you that it is not prudent to appear less than fond of Harry Potter. Not when most of our kind regard him as the hero who made the Dark Lord disappear. Ah, Mr. Borgin." A stooping man had appeared behind the counter, smoothing his greasy hair back from his face.
"Mr. Malfoy, what a pleasure to see you again," said Mr. Borgin, in a voice as oily as his hair. "Delighted. And young Master Malfoy, too, charmed. How may I be of assistance? I must show you. Just in today, and very reasonably priced."
"I'm not buying today, Mr. Borgin, but selling," said Mr. Malfoy.
"Selling?"
The smile faded slightly from Mr. Borgin's face. "You have heard, of course, that the Ministry is conducting more raids," said Mr. Malfoy, taking a roll of parchment from his inside pocket and unravelling it for Mr. Borgin to read. "I have a few, items at home that might embarrass me if the Ministry were to call." Mr. Borgin fixed a pair of pince-nez to his nose and looked down the list.
"The Ministry wouldn't presume to trouble you, sir, surely?"
Mr. Malfoy's lip curled. "I have not been visited yet. The name Malfoy still commands a certain respect, yet the Ministry grows ever more meddlesome. There are rumours about a new Muggle Protection Act. No doubt that flea-bitten, muggle-loving fool Arthur Weasley is behind it." Harry felt a hot surge of anger. "And, as you see, certain of these poisons might make it appear..."
"I understand, sir, of course," said Mr. Borgin. "Let me see."
"Can I have that?" interrupted Draco, pointing at the withered hand on its cushion.
"Ah, the Hand of Glory," said Mr. Borgin, abandoning Mr. Malfoy's list and scurrying over to Draco. "Insert a candle, and it gives light only to the holder. Best friend of thieves and plunderers. Your son has fine taste, sir."
"I hope my son will amount to more than a thief or a plunderer, Borgin," said Mr. Malfoy coldly, and Mr. Borgin said quickly,
"Oh, no offence, sir, no offence meant."
"Though if his school marks don't pick up," said Mr. Malfoy, more coldly still, "that may indeed be all he is fit for."
"It's not my fault," retorted Draco. "The teachers all have favourites, that Hermione Granger. I would have thought you'd be ashamed that a girl of no wizard family beat you in every exam," snapped Mr. Malfoy.
"Ha," said Harry, under his breath, pleased to see Draco looking both abashed and angry.
"It's the same all over," said Mr. Borgin in his oily voice. "Wizard blood is counting for less everywhere."
"Not with me," said Mr. Malfoy, his long nostrils flaring.
"No, sir, nor with me, sir,"
said Mr. Borgin, with a deep bow.
"In that case, perhaps we can return to my list," said Mr. Malfoy shortly. "I am in something of a hurry, Borgin. I have important business elsewhere today."
They started to haggle. Harry watched nervously as Draco drew nearer and nearer to his hiding place, examining the objects for sale. He paused to examine a long coil of hangman's rope, and to read, smirking, the card propped on a magnificent necklace of opals, "Caution, do not touch, cursed, has claimed the lives of 19 Muggle owners to date." Draco turned away and saw the cabinet right in front of him. He walked forward. He stretched out his hand for the handle.
"Done," said Mr. Malfoy at the counter. "Come, Draco."
Harry wiped his forehead on his sleeve as Draco turned away.
"Good day to you, Mr. Borgin. I'll expect you at the manor tomorrow to pick up the goods."
The moment the door had closed, Mr. Borgin dropped his oily manner.
"Good day yourself, Mr. Malfoy. And if the stories are true, you haven't sold me half of what's hidden in your manor."
muttering darkly. Mr. Borgin disappeared into a back room. Harry waited for a minute in case he came back, then, quietly as he could, slipped out of the cabinet, past the glass cases, and out of the shop door. Clutching his broken glasses to his face, he stared around. He had emerged into a dingy alleyway that seemed to be made up entirely of shops devoted to the dark arts. The one he had just left, Borgin and Burke's, looked like the largest, but opposite was a nasty window display of shrunken heads, and two doors down a large cage was alive with gigantic black spiders. Two shabby-looking wizards were watching him from the shadow of a doorway, muttering to each other. Feeling jumpy, Harry set off, trying to hold his glasses on straight and hoping against hope he'd be able to find a way out of there. An old wooden street sign hanging over a shop selling poisonous candles told him he was in Nocturne Alley. This didn't help, as Harry had never heard of such a place. He supposed he hadn't spoken clearly enough through his mouthful of ashes back in the Weasleys' fire. Trying to stay calm, he wondered what to do.
"Not lost, are you, my dear?"
said a voice in his ear, making him jump. An aged witch stood in front of him, holding a tray of what looked horribly like whole human fingernails. She leered at him, showing mossy teeth. Harry backed away.
"I'm fine, thanks," he said. "I'm just..."
"Harry! What do you think you're doing down there?"
Harry's heart leapt. So did the witch. A load of fingernails cascaded down over her feet, and she cursed as the massive form of Hagrid, the Hogwarts gamekeeper, came striding towards them, beetle-black eyes flashing over his great bristling beard.
"Hagrid!" Harry croaked in relief. "I was lost. Flue powder."
Hagrid seized Harry by the scruff of the neck and pulled him away from the witch, knocking the tray right out of her hands. Her shrieks followed them all the way along the twisting alleyway out into bright sunlight. Harry saw a familiar snow-white marble building in the distance, Gringotts Bank. Hagrid had steered him right into Diagon Alley.
"You're a mess," said Hagrid gruffly, brushing soot off Harry so forcefully he nearly knocked him into a barrel of dragon dung outside an apothecary. "Skulking around Nocturne Alley? I don't know. Dodgy place, Harry. Don't want no one to see you down there."
"I realized that," said Harry, ducking as Hagrid made to brush him off again. "I told you I was lost. What were you doing down there, anyway?"
"I was looking for a flesh-eating slug repellent," growled Hagrid. "They're ruining the school cabbages. You're not on your own."
"I'm staying with the Weasleys, but we got separated," Harry explained. "I've got to go and find them." They set off together down the street.
"How come you never wrote back to me?"
said Hagrid, as Harry jogged alongside him. He had to take three steps to every stride of Hagrid's enormous boots. Harry explained all about Dobby and the Dursleys.
"Ruddy muggles," growled Hagrid. "If I'd have known..."
"Harry! Harry, over here!"
Harry looked up and saw Hermione Granger standing at the top of the white flight of steps to Gringotts. She ran down to meet them, her bushy brown hair flying behind her.
"What happened to your glasses? Hello, Hagrid. Oh, it's wonderful to see you two again. Are you coming into Gringotts, Harry?"
"As soon as I found the Weasleys," said Harry.
"You won't have long to wait," grinned Hagrid.
Harry and Hermione looked around. Sprinting up the crowded street were Ron, Fred, George, Percy, and Mr. Weasley.
"Harry," Mr. Weasley panted, "we hoped you'd only gone one grade too far."
He mopped his glistening bald patch.
"Molly's frantic. She's coming now."
"Where did you come out?" Ron asked.
"Nocturne Alley," said Hagrid grimly.
"Brilliant,"
said Fred and George together.
"We've never been allowed in," said Ron enviously.
"I should ruddy well think not," growled Hagrid.
Mrs. Weasley now came galloping into view, her handbag swinging wildly in one hand, Ginny just clinging on to the other.
"Oh, Harry, oh, my dear, you could have been anywhere." gasping for breath, she pulled a large clothes brush out of her bag and began sweeping off the soot Hagrid hadn't managed to beat away. Mr. Weasley took Harry's glasses, gave them a tap of his wand, and returned them, good as new.
"Well, got to be off,"
said Hagrid, who was having his hand wrung by Mrs. Weasley.
"Nocturne Alley! If you hadn't found him, Hagrid!"
"See you at Hogwarts."
And he strode away, head and shoulders taller than anyone else in the packed street.
"Guess who I saw in Borgin and Burke's?" Harry asked Ron and Hermione as they climbed the Gringotts steps. "Malfoy and his father."
"Did Lucius Malfoy buy anything?" said Mr. Weasley, sharply behind them.
"No, he was selling."
"So he's worried," said Mr. Weasley with grim satisfaction. "Oh, I'd love to get Lucius Malfoy for something."
"You be careful, Arthur,"
said Mrs. Weasley sharply, as they were ushered into the bank by a bowing goblin at the door.
"That family's trouble. Don't go biting off more than you can chew."
"So you don't think I'm a match for Lucius Malfoy?"
said Mr. Weasley indignantly. But he was distracted almost at once by the sight of Hermione's parents, who were standing nervously at the counter that ran all along the great marble hall, waiting for Hermione to introduce them.
"But you're muggles," said Mr. Weasley delightedly. "We must have a drink. What's that you've got there? Oh, you're changing muggle money. Molly, look!"
He pointed excitedly at the 10-pound notes in Mr. Granger's hand.
"Meet you back here," Ron said to Hermione, as the Weasleys and Harry were led off to their underground vaults by another Gringotts goblin.
The vaults were reached by means of small, goblin-driven carts that sped along miniature train tracks through the bank's underground tunnels. Harry enjoyed the breakneck journey down to the Weasleys' vault, but felt dreadful, far worse than he had in Nocturne Alley when it was opened. There was a very small pile of silver sickles inside, and just one gold galleon. Mrs. Weasley felt right into the corners before sweeping the whole lot into her bag. Harry felt even worse when they reached his vault. He tried to block the contents from view as he hastily shoved handfuls of coins into a leather bag. Back outside, on the marble steps, they all separated. Percy muttered vaguely about needing a new quill. Fred and George had spotted their friend from Hogwarts, Lee Jordan. Mrs. Weasley and Ginny were going to a second-hand robe shop. Mr. Weasley was insisting on taking the Grangers off to the Leaky Cauldron for a drink.
"We'll all meet at Flourish and Blotts in an hour to buy your school books," said Mrs. Weasley, setting off with Ginny. "And not one step down Nocturne Alley,"
she shouted at the twins' retreating backs. Harry, Ron, and Hermione strolled off along the winding cobbled street. The bag of gold, silver, and bronze, jangling cheerfully in Harry's pocket, was clamouring to be spent. So he bought 3 large strawberry and peanut butter ice creams, which they slurped happily as they wandered up the alley, examining the fascinating shop windows. Ron gazed longingly at a full set of Chudley Cannon robes in the windows of Quality Quidditch Supplies, until Hermione dragged them off to buy ink and parchment next door. In Gamble and Jape's Wizarding Joke Shop, they met Fred, George and Lee Jordan, who were stocking up on Dr. Filibuster's fabulous Wet Start, No Heat fireworks. And in a tiny junk shop full of broken wands, wonky brass scales and old cloaks covered in potion stains, they found Percy deeply immersed in a small and deeply boring book called Prefects Who Gained Power. "A study of Hogwarts prefects and their later careers," Ron read aloud off the back cover.
"That sounds fascinating."
"Go away," Percy snapped. "Of course, he's very ambitious, Percy. He's got it all planned out. He wants to be Minister of Magic," Ron told Harry and Hermione in an undertone as they left Percy to it. An hour later, they headed for Flourish and Blotts. They were by no means the only ones making their way to the bookshop. As they approached it, they saw to their surprise a large crowd jostling outside the doors, trying to get in.
The reason for this was proclaimed by a large banner stretched across the upper windows. Gilderoy Lockhart will be signing copies of his autobiography, Magical Me, today, 12:30 to 4:30 p.m.
"We can actually meet him," Hermione squealed. "I mean, he's written almost the whole book list."
The crowd seemed to be made up mostly of witches around Mrs. Weasley's age. A harassed-looking wizard stood at the door, saying, "Calmly, please, ladies, don't push there. Mind the books now." Harry, Ron and Hermione squeezed inside. A long queue wound right to the back of the shop, where Gilderoy Lockhart was signing his books. They each grabbed a copy of Break with a Banshee and sneaked up the line to where the rest of the Weasleys were standing with Mr. and Mrs. Granger.
"Oh, there you are. Good," said Mrs. Weasley. She sounded breathless and kept patting her hair. "We'll be able to see him in a minute."
Gilderoy Lockhart came slowly into view, seated at a table surrounded by large pictures of his own face, all winking and flashing dazzlingly white teeth at the crowd. The real Lockhart was wearing robes of forget-me-not blue, which exactly matched his eyes. His pointed wizard's hat was set at a jaunty angle on his wavy hair. A short, irritable-looking man was dancing around, taking photographs with a large black camera that emitted puffs of purple smoke with every blinding flash.
"Out of the way there!"
he snarled at Ron, moving back to get a better shot.
"This is for the Daily Prophet!"
"Big deal!" said Ron, rubbing his foot where the photographer had stepped on it. Gilderoy Lockhart heard him. He looked up, he saw Ron, and then he saw Harry. He stared, then he leapt to his feet and positively shouted, "It can't be Harry Potter!" The crowd parted, whispering excitedly. Lockhart dived forward, seized Harry's arm, and pulled him to the front. The crowd burst into applause. Harry's face burned as Lockhart shook his hand for the photographer, who was clicking away madly, wafting thick smoke over the Weasleys. "Nice big smile, Harry," said Lockhart through his own gleaming teeth. "Together you and I are worth the front page." When he finally let go of Harry's hand, Harry could hardly feel his fingers. He tried to sidle back over to the Weasleys, but Lockhart threw an arm around his shoulders and clamped him tightly to his side. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said loudly, waving for quiet. "What an extraordinary moment this is! The perfect moment for me to make a little announcement I've been sitting on for some time. When young Harry here stepped into Flourish and Blotts today, he only wanted to buy my autobiography, which I shall be happy to present him now free of charge." The crowd applauded again. "He had no idea," Lockhart continued, giving Harry a little shake that made his glasses slip to the end of his nose, "that he would shortly be getting much, much more than my book, Magical Me. He and his schoolfellows will, in fact, be getting the real Magical Me. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I have great pleasure and pride in announcing that this September I will be taking up the post of Defence Against the Dark Arts teacher at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry." The crowd cheered and clapped, and Harry found himself being presented with the entire works of Gilderoy Lockhart. Staggering slightly under their weight, he managed to make his way out of the limelight to the edge of the room, where Ginny was standing next to her new cauldron. "You have these," Harry mumbled to her, tipping the books into the cauldron. "I'll buy my own." "Bet you loved that, didn't you, Potter?" said a voice Harry had no trouble recognizing. He straightened up and found himself face to face with Draco Malfoy, who was wearing his usual sneer. "Famous Harry Potter," said Malfoy. "Can't even go into a bookshop without making the front page."
"Leave him alone. He didn't want all that," said Ginny.
It was the first time she had spoken in front of Harry. She was glaring at Malfoy. Potter, you've got yourself a girlfriend, drawled Malfoy.
Ginny went scarlet as Ron and Hermione fought their way over, both clutching stacks of Lockhart's books.
Oh, it's you, said Ron, looking at Malfoy as if he was something unpleasant on the sole of his shoe. Bet you're surprised to see Harry here, eh?
Not as surprised as I am to see you in a shop, Weasley, retorted Malfoy. I suppose your parents will go hungry for a month to pay for that lot.
Ron went as red as Ginny. He dropped his books into the cauldron too and started towards Malfoy, but Harry and Hermione grabbed the back of his jacket.
Ron, said Mr. Weasley, struggling over with Fred and George, what are you doing? It's mad in here. Let's go outside.
Well, well, well. Arthur Weasley. It was Mr. Malfoy. He stood with his hand on Draco's shoulder, sneering in just the same way.
Lucius, said Mr. Weasley, nodding coldly. Busy time at the Ministry, I hear, said Mr. Malfoy. All those raids, I hope they're paying you overtime.
He reached into Ginny's cauldron and extracted from amidst the glossy Lockhart books a very old, very battered copy of A Beginner's Guide to Transfiguration.
Obviously not, he said. Dear me, what's the use of being a disgrace to the name of wizard if they don't even pay you well for it?
Mr. Weasley flushed darker than either Ron or Ginny.
We have a very different idea of what disgraces the name of wizard, Malfoy, he said.
Clearly, said Mr. Malfoy, his pale eyes straying to Mr. and Mrs. Granger, who were watching apprehensively.
The company you keep, Weasley, and I thought your family could sink no lower.
There was a thud of metal as Ginny's cauldron went flying. Mr. Weasley had thrown himself at Mr. Malfoy, knocking him backwards into a bookshelf. Dozens of heavy spell books came thundering down on all their heads. There was a yell of, "Get him, Dad!" from Fred or George. Mrs. Weasley was shrieking, "No, Arthur, no!" The crowd stampeded backwards, knocking more shelves over.
"Gentlemen, please, please!" cried the assistant,
and then, louder than all,
"Break it up there, gents! Break it up!"
Hagrid was wading towards them through the sea of books. In an instant he had pulled Mr. Weasley and Mr. Malfoy apart. Mr. Weasley had a cut lip, and Mr. Malfoy had been hit in the eye by an encyclopedia of toadstools. He was still holding Ginny's old transfiguration book. He thrust it at her, his eyes glittering with malice.
"Here, girl, take your book. It's the best your father can give you."
Pulling himself out of Hagrid's grip, he beckoned to Draco and swept from the shop.
"You should have ignored him, Arthur,"
said Hagrid, almost lifting Mr. Weasley off his feet as he straightened his robes.
"Rotten to the core, the whole family. Everyone knows that. No Malfoy's worth listening to. Bad blood, that's what it is. Come on now, let's get out of here."
The assistant looked as though he wanted to stop them leaving, but he barely came up to Hagrid's waist and seemed to think better of it. They hurried up the street, the Grangers shaking with fright, and Mrs. Weasley beside herself with fury.
"A fine example to set your children, brawling in public. What Gilderoy Lockhart must have thought."
"He was pleased," said Fred. "Didn't you hear him as we were leaving? He was asking that bloke from the Daily Prophet if he'd be able to work the fight into his report. Said it was all publicity."
But it was a subdued group who headed back to the fireside in the leaky cauldron, where Harry, the Weasleys, and all their shopping would be travelling back to the burrow using flu powder. They said goodbye to the Grangers, who were leaving the pub for the Muggle Street on the other side. Mr. Weasley started to ask them how bus stops worked, but stopped quickly at the look on Mrs. Weasley's face. Harry took off his glasses and put them safely in his pocket before helping himself to flu powder. It definitely wasn't his favourite way to travel. Chapter 5. The Whomping Willow. The end of the summer holidays came too quickly for Harry's liking. He was looking forward to getting back to Hogwarts, but his month at the Burrow had been the happiest of his life. It was difficult not to feel jealous of Ron when he thought of the Dursleys and the sort of welcome he could expect next time he turned up in Privet Drive. On their last evening, Mrs. Weasley conjured up a sumptuous dinner, which included all of Harry's favourite things, ending with a mouth-watering treacle pudding. Fred and George rounded off the evening with a display of filibuster fireworks. They filled the kitchen with red and blue stars that bounced from ceiling to wall for at least half an hour. Then it was time for a last mug of hot chocolate and bed. It took a long while to get started next morning. They were up at cockcrow, but somehow they still seemed to have a great deal to do. Mrs. Weasley dashed about in a bad mood, looking for spare socks and quills. People kept colliding on the stairs, half-dressed with bits of toast in their hands, and Mr. Weasley nearly broke his neck, tripping over a stray chicken as he crossed the yard carrying Ginny's trunk to the car. Harry couldn't see how 8 people, 6 large trunks, 2 owls and a rat were going to fit into 1 small Ford Anglia. He had reckoned, of course, without the special features which Mr. Weasley had added. "Not a word to Molly," he whispered to Harry as he opened the boot and showed him how it had been magically expanded so that the trunks fitted easily. When at last they were all in the car, Mrs. Weasley glanced into the back seat, where Harry, Ron, Fred, George and Percy were all sitting comfortably side by side, and said, "Muggles do know more than we give them credit for, don't they?" She and Ginny got into the front seat, which had been stretched so that it resembled a park bench. "I mean, you'd never know it was this roomy from the outside, would you?" Mr. Weasley started up the engine, and they trundled out of the yard, Harry turning back for a last look at the house. He barely had time to wonder when he'd see it again, when they were back. George had forgotten his box of filibuster fireworks. 5 minutes after that, they skidded to a halt in the yard so that Fred could run in for his broomstick. They had almost reached the motorway when Ginny shrieked that she'd left her diary. By the time she had clambered back into the car, they were running very late, and tempers were running high. Mr. Weasley glanced at his watch, and then at his wife. "Molly, dear, no, Arthur." "No one would see. This little button here is an invisibility booster I installed. That'd get us up in the air, then we fly above the clouds. We'd be there in 10 minutes, and no one would be any the wiser." "I said no, Arthur, not in broad daylight." They reached King's Cross at 11:15. Mr. Weasley dashed across the road to get trolleys for their trunks, and they all hurried into the station. Harry had caught the Hogwarts Express the previous year. The tricky bit was getting on to platform 9¾, which wasn't visible to the Muggle eye. What you had to do was walk through the solid barrier dividing platforms 9 and 10. It didn't hurt, but it had to be done carefully so that none of the Muggles noticed you vanishing. "Percy first," said Mrs. Weasley, looking nervously at the clock overhead, which showed they had only 5 minutes to disappear casually through the barrier. Percy strode briskly forward and vanished. Mr. Weasley went next. Fred and George followed. "I'll take Ginny, and you two come right after us," Mrs. Weasley told Harry and Ron, grabbing Ginny's hand and setting off. In the blink of an eye, they were gone. "Let's go together. We've only got a minute," Ron said to Harry. Harry made sure that Hedwig's cage was safely wedged on top of his trunk and wheeled his trolley about to face the barrier. He felt perfectly confident. This wasn't nearly as uncomfortable as using flu powder. Both of them bent low over the handles of their trolleys and walked purposefully towards the barrier, gathering speed. A few feet away from it, they broke into a run and... crash! Both trolleys hit the barrier and bounced backwards. Ron's trunk fell off with a loud thump. Harry was knocked off his feet, and Hedwig's cage bounced onto the shiny floor, and she rolled away, shrieking indignantly. People all around them stared, and a guard nearby yelled, "What in blazes do you think you're doing?" "Lost control of the trolley," Harry gasped, clutching his ribs as he got up.
Ron ran to pick up Hedwig, who was causing such a scene that there was a lot of muttering about cruelty to animals from the surrounding crowd.
"Why can't we get through?" Harry hissed to Ron.
"I don't know."
Ron looked wildly around. A dozen curious people were still watching them.
"We're going to miss the train,"
Ron whispered.
"I don't understand why the gateway sealed itself."
Harry looked up at the giant clock with a sickening feeling in the pit of his stomach. 10 seconds. 9 seconds. He wheeled his trolley forward cautiously until it was right against the barrier and pushed with all his might. The metal remained solid. 3 seconds. 2 seconds. 1 second.
"It's gone," said Ron, sounding stunned. "The train's left. What if Mum and Dad can't get back through to us? Have you got any Muggle money?"
Harry gave a hollow laugh. "The Dursleys haven't given me pocket money for about 6 years." Ron pressed his ear to the cold barrier.
"Can't hear a thing," he said tensely.
"What are we going to do? I don't know how long it'll take Mum and Dad to get back to us."
They looked around. People were still watching them, mainly because of Hedwig's continuing screeches. "I think we'd better go and wait by the car," said Harry. "We're attracting too much attention."
"Harry!"
said Ron, his eyes gleaming.
"The car!"
"What about it?"
"We can fly the car to Hogwarts."
"But I thought..."
"We're stuck, right? And we've got to get to school, haven't we? And even underage wizards are allowed to use magic if it's a real emergency. Section 19 or something of the restriction of thingy."
Harry's feeling of panic turned suddenly to excitement.
"Can you fly it?"
"No problem,"
said Ron, wheeling his trolley around to face the exit.
"Come on, let's go. If we hurry, we'll be able to follow the Hogwarts Express."
And they marched off through the crowd of curious muggles, out of the station and back into the side road where the old Ford Anglia was parked. Ron unlocked the cavernous boot with a series of taps from his wand. They heaved their trunks back in, put Hedwig on the back seat, and got into the front.
"Check no one's watching," said Ron,
starting the ignition with another tap of his wand. Harry stuck his head out of the window. Traffic was rumbling along the main road ahead, but their street was empty.
"Okay," he said.
Ron pressed a tiny silver button on the dashboard. The car around them vanished, and so did they. Harry could feel the seat vibrating beneath him, hear the engine, feel his hands on his knees and his glasses on his nose, but for all he could see, he had become a pair of eyeballs, floating a few feet above the ground in a dingy street full of parked cars.
"Let's go," said Ron's voice from his right.
The ground and the dirty buildings on either side fell away, dropping out of sight as the car rose. In seconds, the whole of London lay, smoky and glittering, below them. Then there was a popping noise, and the car, Harry and Ron, reappeared.
"Uh-oh," said Ron, jabbing at the invisibility booster.
"It's faulty."
Both of them pummeled it. The car vanished. Then it flickered back again.
"Hold on!" Ron yelled, and he slammed his foot on the accelerator. They shot straight into the low, woolly clouds, and everything turned dull and foggy.
"Now what?" said Harry, blinking at the solid mass of cloud pressing in on them from all sides.
"We need to see the train to know what direction to go in," said Ron. "Dip back down again, quickly."
They dropped back beneath the clouds and twisted around in their seats, squinting at the ground.
"I can see it," Harry yelled. "Right ahead, there."
The Hogwarts Express was streaking along below them like a scarlet snake.
"Due north," said Ron, checking the compass on the dashboard.
"Okay, we'll just have to check on it every half an hour or so.
Hold on."
And they shot up through the clouds. A minute later, they burst out into a blaze of sunlight. It was a different world. The wheels of the car skimmed the sea of fluffy cloud, the sky a bright, endless blue under the blinding white sun.
"All we've got to worry about now are aeroplanes," said Ron.
They looked at each other and started to laugh. For a long time they couldn't stop. It was as though they had been plunged into a fabulous dream.
This, thought Harry, was surely the only way to travel. Past swirls and turrets of snowy cloud, in a car full of hot, bright sunlight, with a fat pack of toffees in the glove compartment, and the prospect of seeing Fred and George's jealous faces when they landed smoothly and spectacularly on the sweeping lawn in front of Hogwarts Castle. They made regular checks on the train as they flew further and further north, each dip beneath the clouds showing them a different view. London was soon far behind them, replaced by neat green fields, which gave way in turn to wide purplish moors, villages with tiny toy churches, and a great city alive with cars like multicoloured ants. Several uneventful hours later, however, Harry had to admit that some of the fun was wearing off. The toffees had made them extremely thirsty, and they had nothing to drink. He and Ron had pulled off their jumpers, but Harry's T-shirt was sticking to the back of his seat, and his glasses kept sliding down to the end of his sweaty nose. He had stopped noticing the fantastic cloud shapes now, and was thinking longingly of the train miles below, where you could buy ice-cold pumpkin juice from a trolley pushed by a plump witch. Why hadn't they been able to get onto platform 9 3/4?
"Can't be much further, can it?" croaked Ron, hours later still, as the sun started to sink into their floor of cloud, staining it a deep pink. "Ready for another check on the train?" It was still right below them, winding its way past a snow-capped mountain. It was much darker beneath the canopy of clouds. Ron put his foot on the accelerator and drove them upwards again. But as he did so, the engine began to whine. Harry and Ron exchanged nervous glances.
"It's probably just tired," said Ron. "It's never been this far before." And they both pretended not to notice the whining growing louder and louder as the sky became steadily darker. Stars were blossoming in the blackness. Harry pulled his jumper back on, trying to ignore the way the windscreen wipers were now waving feebly as though in protest.
"Not far," said Ron, more to the car than to Harry. "Not far now," and he patted the dashboard nervously.
When they flew back beneath the clouds a little while later, they had to squint through the darkness for a landmark they knew.
"There!" Harry shouted, making Ron and Hedwig jump. "Straight ahead!"
Silhouetted on the dark horizon, high on the cliff over the lake, stood the many turrets and towers of Hogwarts Castle. But the car had begun to shudder and was losing speed.
"Come on," Ron said cajolingly, giving the steering wheel a little shake. "Nearly there. Come on!"
The engine groaned. Narrow jets of steam were issuing from under the bonnet. Harry found himself gripping the edges of his seat very hard as they flew towards the lake. The car gave a nasty wobble. Glancing out of his window, Harry saw the smooth, black, glassy surface of the water a mile below. Ron's knuckles were white on the steering wheel. The car wobbled again.
"Come on!" Ron muttered.
They were over the lake. The castle was right ahead. Ron put his foot down. There was a loud clunk, a splutter, and the engine died completely.
"Uh-oh," said Ron into the silence.
The nose of the car dropped. They were falling, gathering speed, heading straight for the solid castle wall.
"No!"
Ron yelled, swinging the steering wheel around. They missed the dark stone wall by inches as the car turned in a great arc, soaring over the dark greenhouses, then the vegetable patch, and then out over the black lawns, losing height all the time. Ron let go of the steering wheel completely and pulled his wand out of his back pocket.
"Stop! Stop!"
he yelled, whacking the dashboard and the windscreen, but they were still plummeting, the ground flying up towards them.
"Mind that tree!"
Harry bellowed, lunging for the steering wheel, but too late.
Crunch!
With an ear-splitting bang of metal on wood, they hit the thick tree trunk and dropped to the ground with a heavy jolt. Steam was billowing from under the crumpled bonnet. Hedwig was shrieking in terror. A golf-ball-sized lump was throbbing on Harry's head where he had hit the windscreen, and to his right, Ron let out a low, despairing groan.
"Are you okay?" Harry said urgently.
"My wand," said Ron in a shaky voice.
"Look at my wand!"
It had snapped, almost in two. The tip was dangling limply, held on by a few splinters. Harry opened his mouth to say he was sure they'd be able to mend it up at the school, but he never even got started. At that very moment, something hit his side of the car with the force of a charging bull, sending him lurching sideways into Ron, just as an equally heavy blow hit the roof.
"What's happened?"
Ron gasped, staring through the windscreen, and Harry looked around just in time to see a branch as thick as a python smash into it. The tree they had hit was attacking them. Its trunk was bent almost double, and its gnarled boughs were pummeling every inch of the car it could reach. "Ah!" said Ron, as another twisted limb punched a large dent into his door. The windscreen was now trembling under a hail of blows from knuckle-like twigs, and a branch as thick as a battering ram was pounding furiously on the roof, which seemed to be caving in.
"Run for it!"
Ron shouted, throwing his full weight against his door. But next second he had been knocked backwards into Harry's lap by a vicious uppercut from another branch.
"We're done for!"
he moaned as the ceiling sagged. But suddenly the floor of the car was vibrating. The engine had restarted.
"Reverse!"
Harry yelled, and the car shot backwards. The tree was still trying to hit them. They could hear its roots creaking as it almost ripped itself up, lashing out at them as they sped out of reach.
"That," panted Ron, "was close. Well done, car!"
The car, however, had reached the end of its tether. With two smart clunks, the doors flew open, and Harry felt his seat tip sideways. Next thing he knew, he was sprawled on the damp ground. Loud thuds told him that the car was ejecting their luggage from the boot. Hedwig's cage flew through the air and burst open. She rose out of it with a loud, angry screech, and sped off towards the castle without a backwards look. Then, dented, scratched, and steaming, the car rumbled off into the darkness, its rear lights blazing angrily.
"Come back!"
Ron yelled after it, brandishing his broken wand.
"Dad'll kill me!"
But the car disappeared from view with one last snort from its exhaust.
"Can you believe our luck?"
said Ron miserably, bending down to pick up Scabbers the rat. "Of all the trees we could have hit, we had to get one that hits back." He glanced over his shoulder at the ancient tree, which was still flailing its branches threateningly.
"Come on," said Harry wearily. "We'd better get up to the school."
It wasn't at all the triumphant arrival they had pictured. Stiff, cold, and bruised, they seized the ends of their trunks and began dragging them up the grassy slope towards the great oak front doors. "I think the feast's already started," said Ron, dropping his trunk at the foot of the front steps and crossing quietly to look through a brightly lit window. "Hey, Harry, come and look. It's the sorting!" Harry hurried over, and together he and Ron peered in at the great hall. Innumerable candles were hovering in mid-air over four long, crowded tables, making the golden plates and goblets sparkle. Overhead, the bewitched ceiling, which always mirrored the sky outside, sparkled with stars. Through the forest of pointed black Hogwarts hats, Harry saw a long line of scared-looking first years filing into the hall. Ginny was amongst them, easily visible because of her vivid Weasley hair. Meanwhile, Professor McGonagall, a bespectacled witch with her hair in a tight bun, was placing the famous Hogwarts sorting hat on a stool before the newcomers. Every year, this aged old hat, patched, frayed and dirty, sorted new students into the four Hogwarts houses, Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw and Slytherin. Harry well remembered putting it on exactly 1 year ago and waiting, petrified, for its decision as it muttered aloud in his ear. For a few horrible seconds he had feared that the hat was going to put him in Slytherin, the house which had turned out more dark witches and wizards than any other. But he had ended up in Gryffindor, along with Ron, Hermione, and the rest of the Weasleys. Last term, Harry and Ron had helped Gryffindor win the house championship, beating Slytherin for the first time in 7 years. A very small, mousy-haired boy had been called forward to place the hat on his head. Harry's eyes wandered past him to where Professor Dumbledore, the headmaster, sat watching the sorting from the staff table, his long silver beard and half-moon glasses shining brightly in the candlelight. Several seats along, Harry saw Gilderoy Lockhart, dressed in robes of aquamarine. And there at the end was Hagrid, huge and hairy, drinking deeply from his goblet.
"Hang on," Harry muttered to Ron. "There's an empty chair at the staff table. Where's Snape?"
Professor Severus Snape was Harry's least favourite teacher. Harry also happened to be Snape's least favourite student. Cruel, sarcastic, and disliked by everybody except the students from his own house, Slytherin, Snape taught potions.
"Maybe he's ill," said Ron, hopefully.
"Maybe he's left," said Harry, "because he missed out on the Defence Against Dark Arts job again."
"Or he might have been sacked," said Ron enthusiastically. "I mean, everyone hates him."
"Or maybe," said a very cold voice right behind them, "he's waiting to hear why you two didn't arrive on the school train." Harry spun around. There, his black robes rippling in a cold breeze, stood Severus Snape. He was a thin man with sallow skin, a hooked nose and greasy shoulder-length black hair, and at this moment he was smiling in a way that told Harry he and Ron were in very deep trouble. "Follow me," said Snape. Not daring even to look at each other, Harry and Ron followed Snape up the steps into the vast, echoing entrance hall, which was lit with flaming torches. A delicious smell of food was wafting from the great hall, but Snape led them away from the warmth and light down a narrow stone staircase that led into the dungeons. "In," he said, opening a door halfway down the cold passageway and pointing. They entered Snape's office, shivering. The shadowy walls were lined with shelves of large glass jars, in which floated all manner of revolting things Harry didn't really want to know the name of at the moment. The fireplace was dark and empty. Snape closed the door and turned to look at them. "So," he said softly, "the train isn't good enough for the famous Harry Potter and his faithful sidekick Weasley. Wanted to arrive with a bang, did we, boys?"
"No, sir, it was the barrier at King's Cross. It—"
"Silence," said Snape coldly. "What have you done with the car?" Ron gulped. This wasn't the first time Snape had given Harry the impression of being able to read minds. But a moment later he understood, as Snape unrolled today's issue of the Evening Prophet.
"You were seen," he hissed, showing them the headline.
"Flying Ford Anglia mystifies Muggles." He began to read aloud. "Two Muggles in London, convinced they saw an old car flying over the post office tower. At noon in Norfolk, Mrs. Hetty Bailey's, while hanging out her washing, Mr. Angus Fleet of Peebles reported to police, 6 or 7 Muggles in all."
I believe your father works in the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts office, he said, looking up at Ron and smiling still more nastily. Dear, dear, his own son. Harry felt as though he'd just been walloped in the stomach by one of the mad tree's larger branches. If anyone found out Mr. Weasley had bewitched the car, he hadn't thought of that. I noticed in my search of the park that considerable damage seems to have been done to a very valuable whomping willow, Snape went on.
That tree did more damage to us than we, Ron blurted out.
Silence! Snapped Snape again. Most unfortunately, you are not in my house, and the decision to expel you does not rest with me. I shall go and fetch the people who do have that happy power. You will wait here. Harry and Ron stared at each other, white-faced. Harry didn't feel hungry any more. He now felt extremely sick. He tried not to look at a large, slimy something suspended in green liquid on a shelf behind Snape's desk. If Snape had gone to fetch Professor McGonagall, head of Gryffindor House, they were hardly any better off. She might be fairer than Snape, but she was still extremely strict. 10 minutes later, Snape returned, and sure enough, it was Professor McGonagall who accompanied him. Harry had seen Professor McGonagall angry on several occasions, but either he had forgotten just how thin her mouth could go, or he had never seen her this angry before. She raised her wand the moment she entered. Harry and Ron both flinched, but she merely pointed it at the empty fireplace, where flames suddenly erupted.
"Sit!"
she said, and they both backed into chairs by the fire.
"Explain!"
she said, her glasses glinting ominously. Ron launched into the story, starting with the barrier at the station refusing to let them through.
"So we had no choice, Professor. We couldn't get on the train. Why didn't you send us a letter by owl?"
"I believe you have an owl," Professor McGonagall said coldly to Harry. Harry gaped at her. Now she said it, that seemed the obvious thing to have done. I didn't think.
That, said Professor McGonagall, is obvious.
There was a knock on the office door, and Snape, now looking happier than ever, opened it. There stood the headmaster, Professor Dumbledore. Harry's whole body went numb. Dumbledore was looking unusually grave. He stared down his very crooked nose at them, and Harry suddenly found himself wishing he and Ron were still being beaten up by the whomping willow. There was a long silence. Then Dumbledore said, "Please explain why you did this." It would have been better if he had shouted. Harry hated the disappointment in his voice. For some reason, he was unable to look Dumbledore in the eyes, and spoke instead to his knees. He told Dumbledore everything, except that Mr. Weasley owned the bewitched car, making it sound as though he and Ron had happened to find a flying car parked outside the station. He knew Dumbledore would see through this at once, but Dumbledore asked no questions about the car. When Harry had finished, he merely continued to peer at them through his spectacles. "We'll go and get our stuff," said Ron, in a hopeless sort of voice.
"What are you talking about, Weasley?"
barked Professor McGonagall.
"Well, you're expelling us, aren't you?"
said Ron. Harry looked quickly at Dumbledore.
"Not today, Mr. Weasley," said Dumbledore. "But I must impress upon both of you the seriousness of what you have done. I will be writing to both your families tonight. I must also warn you that if you do anything like this again, I will have no choice but to expel you."
Snape looked as though Christmas had been cancelled. He cleared his throat and said, "Professor Dumbledore, these boys have flouted the decree for the restriction of underage wizardry, caused serious damage to an old and valuable tree. Surely acts of this nature—"
"It will be for Professor McGonagall to decide on these boys' punishment, Severus," said Dumbledore calmly. "They are in her house, and are therefore her responsibility."
He turned to Professor McGonagall. "I must go back to the feast, Minerva. I've got to give out a few notices. Come, Severus, there's a delicious-looking custard tart I want to sample." Snape shot a look of pure venom at Harry and Ron as he allowed himself to be swept out of his office, leaving them alone with Professor McGonagall, who was still eyeing them like a wrathful eagle.
"You'd better get along to the hospital wing, Weasley. You're bleeding."
"Not much," said Ron, hastily wiping the cut over his eye with his sleeve.
"Professor, I wanted to watch my sister being sorted." "The sorting ceremony is over," said Professor McGonagall. "Your sister is also in Gryffindor."
"Oh, good," said Ron.
"And speaking of Gryffindor," Professor McGonagall said sharply, but Harry cut in. "Professor, when we took the car, term hadn't started, so Gryffindor shouldn't really have points taken from it, should it?" he finished, watching her anxiously.
Professor McGonagall gave him a piercing look, but he was sure she had almost smiled. Her mouth looked less thin, anyway.
"I will not take any points from Gryffindor," she said,
and Harry's heart lightened considerably.
"But you will both get a detention."
It was better than Harry had expected. As for Dumbledore's writing to the Dursleys, that was nothing. Harry knew perfectly well they'd just be disappointed that the Whomping Willow hadn't squashed him flat. Professor McGonagall raised her wand again and pointed it at Snape's desk. A large plate of sandwiches, two silver goblets, and a jug of iced pumpkin juice appeared with a pop.
"You will eat in here and then go straight up to your dormitory," she said. "I must also return to the feast."
When the door had closed behind her, Ron let out a long, low whistle.
"I thought we'd had it," he said, grabbing a sandwich.
"So did I," said Harry, taking one too.
"Can you believe our luck, though?"
said Ron thickly through a mouthful of chicken and ham.
"Fred and George must have flown that car 5 or 6 times, and no muggle ever saw them."
He swallowed and took another huge bite.
"Why couldn't we get through the barrier?"
Harry shrugged. "We'll have to watch our step from now on, though," he said, taking a grateful swig of pumpkin juice.
"Wish we could have gone up to the feast."
"She didn't want us showing off," said Ron sagely. "Doesn't want people to think it's clever, arriving by flying car." When they had eaten as many sandwiches as they could, the plate kept refilling itself, they rose and left the office, treading the familiar path to Gryffindor Tower. The castle was quiet. It seemed that the feast was over. They walked past muttering portraits and creaking suits of armour, and climbed narrow flights of stone stairs, until at last they reached the passage where the secret entrance to Gryffindor Tower was hidden, behind an oil painting of a very fat woman in a pink silk dress.
"Password," she said, as they approached.
Said Harry. They didn't know the New Year's password, not having met a Gryffindor prefect yet, but help came almost immediately. They heard hurrying feet behind them and turned to see Hermione dashing towards them.
"There you are! Where have you been? The most ridiculous rumours! Someone said you'd been expelled for crashing a flying car!"
"Well, we haven't been expelled," Harry assured her.
"You're not telling me you did fly here,"
said Hermione, sounding almost as severe as Professor McGonagall.
"Skip the lecture," said Ron impatiently, "and tell us the new password." "It's Wattlebird," said Hermione impatiently, "but that's not the point."
Her words were cut short, however, as the portrait of the fat lady swung open, and there was a sudden storm of clapping. It looked as though the whole of Gryffindor House was still awake, packed into the circular common room, standing on the lopsided tables and squashy armchairs, waiting for them to arrive. Arms reached through the portrait hole to pull Harry and Ron inside, leaving Hermione to scramble in after them.
"Brilliant!" yelled Lee Jordan. "Inspired! What an entrance! Flying a car right into the Whomping Willow. People will be talking about that one for years."
"Good on you," said a fifth year Harry had never spoken to. Someone was patting him on the back as though he'd just won a marathon. Fred and George pushed their way to the front of the crowd and said together,
"Why couldn't you have called us back, eh?"
Ron was scarlet in the face, grinning embarrassedly, but Harry could see one person who didn't look happy at all. Percy was visible over the heads of some excited first years, and he seemed to be trying to get near enough to start telling them off. Harry nudged Ron in the ribs and nodded in Percy's direction. Ron got the point at once.
"Got to get upstairs. Bit tired," he said, and the two of them started pushing their way towards the door on the other side of the room, which led to a spiral staircase and the dormitories.
"Night," Harry called back to Hermione, who was wearing a scowl just like Percy's. They managed to get to the other side of the common room, still having their backs slapped, and gained the piece of the staircase. They hurried up it, right to the top, and at last reached the door of their old dormitory, which now had a sign on it saying, "Second Years." They entered the familiar circular room, with its 5 four-posters hung with red velvet, and its high, narrow windows. Their trunks had been brought up for them, and placed at the ends of their beds. Ron grinned guiltily at Harry.
"I know I shouldn't have enjoyed that or anything, but..."
The dormitory door flew open, and in came the other second-year Gryffindor boys, Seamus Finnegan, Dean Thomas, and Neville Longbottom.
"Unbelievable!" beamed Seamus.
"Cool," said Dean.
"Amazing," said Neville, awestruck.
Harry couldn't help it. He grinned, too.